From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Theresa May says she will remain as British Prime Minister despite yesterday's election, which she had called for a show of support, but instead her party lost its majority in Parliament. After a brief meeting today with Queen Elizabeth, who has to okay the formation of a new coalition government, May said she will form one with Northern Ireland's Democratic Unionist Party.
This government will guide the country through the crucial Brexit talks that begin in just 10 days and deliver on the will of the British people by taking the United Kingdom out of the European Union.
Theresa May had hoped the election would strengthen her hand in those Brexit negotiations, but instead her Conservative Party lost seats in Parliament yesterday, while the far-left Labour Party, led by Jeremy Corbyn, surged. Rob Watson is the BBC's political correspondent. He joins us from outside Parliament. And Rob, remind us why seats are so important in a parliamentary system, and how big is this?
Well, it's got to be the most spectacular gambling backfire that has happened in Britain in recent history, although I was about to add David Cameron's decision to call a referendum on Britain's membership of the European Union.
Right.
But basically, it's this. You know, we have our system, there are 650 MPs, and she had been hoping to extend her majority of about 17. I mean, there had been talk at the start of the campaign that she was going to wipe out the opposition Labour Party and end up with a majority of 150, 200, something like that. Oops, after a totally disastrous, inept campaign, she's ended up with fewer seats.
Well, this is a little bit counterintuitive to a lot of Americans because Theresa May represents the Conservative Party. We know they pushed to leave the European Union, very concerned about issues of security and immigration. And the country just had two terrible bombings. And you'd think that that would push people into the arms of the Conservative, but it didn't.
Well, let me just try and tackle Robin a bit more broadly. What, you know, why on earth, given that she was expected to win by a massive landslide and had a huge 25% poll lead at the start, why did she end up losing? And I think it's three things. I think it's first that, you know, one of the things that makes Britain such an agreeable country is that we don't really like politics. We're not that interested. So the voters don't like it if you trouble them for an election which they think is not necessary. So most voters, whether they voted Brexit or not, they couldn't quite think, you know, why exactly are we having this election? You've already got a majority. And so they thought this was, you know, this was opportunistic. Secondly, without going into a massive amount of detail, Theresa May is one of the most wooden politicians you could ever hope to meet, and she fought a fairly woeful campaign. And then as to the security issue and why that didn't help out more, well, it's complicated, and I'm not sure people entirely understand that it's true that security dominated the much of the last bit of the campaign, but I don't think there was any evidence that it worked to Theresa May's favour, despite the fact that, as far as many British voters were concerned, Jeremy Corbyn would be seen to have supported groups that people would consider terrorists, such as the IRA here in the UK or Hamas in the Middle East.
And you're talking about the opposition Labour Party. This is Jeremy Corbyn, the Labour leader, who did much better than was expected. Here he is speaking to Sky News today.
Incredible result for the Labour Party because people voted for hope. Young people and old people all came together yesterday. Very high turnout, huge increase in the Labour vote, and they did it because they want to see things done differently and they want hope in their lives.
So what happens now to the Labour Party now that they had this huge, so they had the huge support in the vote yesterday? Explain how it is that Theresa May forms a government going forward.
Well, she forms a government because under Britain's system, if no party has won an outright majority, the party that's got the most seats and the most votes gets to have first go. And so that's what she's going to see, and we'll see how stable the whole arrangement is. But just to make a kind of broader point about British politics, if you look at the Conservatives, look at Labour, look what's happened. In some ways, there are parallels with the United States in that it almost feels like the centre of British politics has just fallen out. So you have an awful lot of voters, particularly young people, moving very much to support a very far-left Labour Party under the leadership of Jeremy Corbyn. I mean, unashamedly socialist. And, of course, meantime, the Conservative Party has moved off very much to the right. So instead of being the normal old-fashioned sort of pro-business party that it was, it's got itself caught up very much in issues of sovereignty, of being of being hardline on leaving the European Union, being very concerned about immigration. So in a funny way, the politics of the United Kingdom has suddenly become more similar to the politics of, say, the United States, as opposed to Britain's European allies, where in France or in Germany, people seem to be going back towards the centre.
What are people saying today? I mean, it was stunning. How are people just on the streets reacting?
Well, I think the atmosphere on the streets is surprise. I think if you're... there's also a great mix of disappointment among the 13-odd million people who voted Conservative and were thinking, hang on a minute, if there are that many of us, surely we would win a majority. They didn't. And I think a vast amount of happiness, particularly amongst those younger people who voted Labour, partly because there was something else going on here, and that is it's thought that a lot of the younger people who bothered to turn out this time, and here, as in the United States, young people often don't turn out to vote. It's thought they did it in part because they were so fed up about the referendum to leave the European Union, and some of them hadn't turned out to vote then, and they were feeling cross that they didn't vote Remain then, so they were sort of getting in their revenge now.
And what does this do to that Brexit vote and the Brexit negotiations?
It's really hard to say. I mean, people are trying to interpret this vote as being either a criticism or support for Brexit. I think they're really going to struggle. As to what it does to the negotiations, well, I think it's just impossible not to see this as complicating the British government's task, because if you're in the European Union, what are you going to be thinking of if you're a leader there? You're going to be thinking that Britain is now led by a politician who's been damaged and who leads a weak government.
Was there anything else that's just jumping out at you that you...
No. I mean, I think we got the general gist that everyone in Britain has gone utterly bonkers.
BBC political correspondent Rob Watson in London. Rob, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, this week's terrorist attack in Iran, which killed 17 people, came less than a month after an election there. Hassan Rouhani was reelected president, giving new hope to reformers. In addition to terrorism, Rouhani faces other domestic challenges, including the economy. But boosting the economy in Iran may be difficult with a more hawkish administration in Washington. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
The euphoria among Iran's reformers was sweet, perhaps because they knew it would be short-lived. They decisively gave their centrist president a second chance to deliver on the issue that dominated the campaign, whether Rouhani is right when he says Iran must deal with the West, as it did in the 2015 nuclear agreement, to put Iranians back to work. As Rouhani's votes piled up, the mood in Tehran was clear. Saeed Jafari has run an auto parts shop in the Iranian capital for some 25 years. He has a short to-do list for the president.
He should concentrate his efforts on three items: economy, creating jobs, and paying attention to the marginalized people of this nation.
It's easier said than done. Billions of dollars have flowed into Iran's opaque and heavily centralized economy since the nuclear deal freed up the country's frozen overseas assets. A few large business deals have been struck, including a new fleet of Boeing airplanes. But so far, all ordinary Iranians have seen is a slowing of Iran's notorious inflation rate, not the dramatic jump-starting of the economy they kept hearing about during Rouhani's first term. Sitting in a Western-style coffee shop, engineer Masoud Ashari says re-electing Rouhani, with his willingness to engage the world, is important in itself. But now he really needs to show some results that people can feel.
4 years ago, the people wants to change something, but now we are at the half of the way. So I think in next 4 years, Mr. Rouhani must respond to the people who vote for him for the second time.
But Rouhani will have to deal with conservative factions who vow to fight what they see as damaging outside influences. Perhaps more importantly, he's also facing a new administration in Washington, eager to threaten, punish, and isolate Iran. Analyst Ali Vaez at the International Crisis Group says it's now clear that the last 4 years of President Obama in Washington and Rouhani in Tehran were an extremely rare matchup of U.S. and Iranian leaders who both favored diplomacy over sanctions and military threats.
It has rarely happened in the past 38-year history of Iran and the United States that two countries have been on the same page at the same time. The stars really aligned during Obama's second term and Rouhani's first term, and that's why the nuclear deal was achieved.
Analysts in Tehran also see trouble ahead. Fuad Izadi at Tehran University says it's important to remember that the only reason the nuclear deal survived in the first place was because Obama vetoed congressional efforts to derail it. Now Iran sees what Izadi calls a huge new sanctions bill moving through Congress with little likelihood of a Trump veto.
If that passes, based on the text we are reading, the nuclear agreement more or less becomes ineffective.
Analyst Ali Vaez says Rouhani urgently needs to bring in foreign investment, especially from Europe. Besides bringing in revenue, he says getting Europe more involved in Iran could make it that much harder for Washington to undo the nuclear accord.
The more the European companies have an interest in the continuation of the nuclear deal, the more the Iranians have somebody who could face up to the United States and push back against additional sanctions.
Iranians say if Rouhani is to deliver on his promises, he'll have to find someone willing to do business with Iran, despite the threat of more sanctions from Washington. Peter Kenyon, NPR News.
And we want to bring you a story now that was preempted yesterday by our coverage of the James Comey testimony. We were marking the 150th birthday of the architect Frank Lloyd Wright. Over his seven-decade career, Wright developed a distinct modern American style. Some of his best-known buildings are the Guggenheim Museum in New York and Falling Water, built over a waterfall in Pennsylvania. He also designed furniture, windows, and lighting for his buildings. Joining us now is Frank Lloyd Wright scholar Catherine Smith. And Catherine Smith, can you tell us about that Frank Lloyd Wright style?
Yes, I sure can. But I just want to start out by saying that Frank Lloyd Wright didn't believe in styles. He thought that meant architecture was fashion. So what he actually did do was to create a series of principles or ideas.
And what were those principles and ideas?
Well, the principle, I would start with the first one, and this is in between 1893 and 1902. He said about to be opposing the historic European architecture from ancient Greece to the Victorian England period that was dominating architecture at the turn of the century. And he wanted to create a work and buildings that were designed to human scale, free of European ornamentation, and also an honest expression of materials.
And was there something American about it, do you think?
Absolutely. He defined it in those terms completely. He was influenced by his mentor, Louis Sullivan, who was the greatest architect of the end of the 19th century. He was based in Chicago, Illinois. And so the philosophy behind this was that the United States was a young country, and it deserved its own genuine, true, original architecture, not the architecture of ancient Greece or the Roman Empire.
Now, there are several iconic buildings from Frank Lloyd Wright, Falling Water and the Guggenheim Museum. What do you think makes those so remarkable?
Well, those are the two that are best known to the general public, and they're almost polar opposites in the sense that one is the Falling Water is sited deeply into a beautiful glen in a wooded forest area, and the Guggenheim Museum is right there on Fifth Avenue. So what he was trying to do in either case was to bring a human scale to the building, and in Falling Water you can see his attention to integrating a work of architecture with a beautiful natural landscape site.
What's your favorite Frank Lloyd Wright building?
Well, I have to say, and this is personal on my part, is my favorite is his own house and studio in Wisconsin, which is called Taliesin. And I've been able through the years to be a guest there. I think I've slept in almost every bedroom in the house. Hmm. And it's an exquisite building that's defines actually a term which is Japanese, which is called wabi-sabi. And wabi-sabi is the design philosophy of a rustic, simplistic, simple building that fits itself with nature. And Taliesin is the perfect example of that.
Do you think there's something Midwestern about Frank Lloyd Wright?
Well, I do. Yes, I do. Because it kept him from being integrated into, you know, the East Coast attitude, which is to be closer to Europe. And he was born in 1867, so he was on the edge of the frontier. That's really hard for some of us to believe.
Right.
But Wisconsin only became a state in 1848. So he was a pioneer.
So what do you think is his lasting legacy all these years later?
His lasting legacy is, of course, his built work. He designed just over 1,000, and just half of those are still standing today. But I really feel his legacy is for your audience, and they have homes, and they have a great ability now through his ideas to have your house relate to nature. And through that understanding of nature, we can perhaps address some of the major concerns of sustainability which exist in our era today.
That's Catherine Smith, who is a Frank Lloyd Wright scholar and author of a number of books. Her most recent is Wright on Exhibit, Frank Lloyd Wright's Architectural Exhibitions. Catherine Smith, thank you.
Well, just great to be with you, Jeremy.
Well, because Frank Lloyd Wright designed so many homes, there are plenty of people in this country who have lived in his art, including Kim Bixler, who grew up in a Frank Lloyd Wright house in Rochester, New York, that her parents owned from 1977 to 1994. Kim, welcome.
Thank you very much.
And describe the house for us.
Well, the house was built in 1908, so it was a prairie-style home. It was built around the same time as the Roby House, which is much more famous in Illinois, but it was very, very similar. He wanted a house that kind of fit the landscape, not fought the landscape. It also was like a craftsman-style feel to the house, and the house has 253 stained glass, art glass windows, doors, and light lenses throughout. It's just really spectacular with the lighting.
Did you realize how special it was when you were living in it?
Well, we moved in when I was 8 years old, and right from the beginning, my mom handed me a stack of note cards and said, okay, time to give your first tour. So I used to give tours to architecture students and professors and charities, community groups. So I became pretty familiar with my house. But as I became a teenager, I became very self-conscious and kind of uncomfortable with the house because I felt like people were judging me based on where I lived. And now, of course, I look back and I say, oh, that was such a treasure and such a gem to live there at that time.
Well, what kind of impression did it leave on you and other people who visited the house? I mean, you know, we all go into a lot of different houses throughout our lives, but was there something that was really different about going into your house?
Well, the house still has 17 pieces of original furniture that were designed by Frank Lloyd Wright. So when you walk into the dining room, which is truly the most spectacular room in the house, and it has all of the Frank Lloyd Wright furniture, the chairs, you can see his vision, his total vision. And I'd have a friend come over, and they would just, you know, stop and gasp. And I remember an architect, he came through the house, and he kind of swayed for a minute, and he said, to imagine the imagination of the person who imagined this room. And what the house has is it has all these geometric shapes throughout the house. So the shapes from the windows are the same size as the shapes on the light fixtures, and then that same shape is repeated in the furniture. And so when you walk in, you're not really aware, but you know that there's just this beauty of that room. And it's really quite spectacular.
Now, lest we just talk about the good things in this house, I know that there were also some problems with it. What were they?
Oh, my gosh. Well, typical of many Frank Lloyd Wright homes, the roof was a huge problem. It leaked, and, you know, we were always being summoned out of bed, go grab the pots and pans, get every towel in the house. So, like, every flat roof, I mean, if you did not go out there and start shoveling, this is Rochester, New York, and they have these series of flat roofs that were abutting these clear story windows in the dining room, and the heat from the house as the snow was piling up would melt that snow, and we would create all these water problems, ice dams, and it was a continuous problem. So when my parents purchased the house, the roof cost as much as the house did to repair it.
Well, do you think that Frank Lloyd Wright just missed that part of it, that he or did he just not care about anything but the look and the feel?
I really think that he felt that he wanted it to look beautiful, and you know, the homeowner would have to deal with that. And, you know, there's some famous stories, some wonderful stories that someone wrote to him and said, you know, there's water leaking on my desk, you know, from the roof. And he just wrote back and said, move your desk. you know, for us, it was just a constant, constant battle. But when we did finally repair it, my parents really tried to do it the right way. They took off 7 roofs. Each person was stacking another roof on another roof and another roof. And they went down right to the boards and then put a copper roof on it. And it maintained, it stayed that way for quite a while. But it was definitely an issue for us.
Why did your parents decide to sell the house after 17 years?
Oh, my gosh. My mom never wanted to leave. She really loved the house. She said, if I could put it on a flatbed trailer and take it with me, I would have. But it was Rochester, New York, and my parents are from California, and they were done. The repairs were constant. You know, we went through 3,000 gallons of oil every year to heat the house. We lived in basically one room of the house a lot of times and put on lots of sweaters and literally blankets. So there were definitely some downsides to that house.
If somebody out there is considering buying a Frank Lloyd Wright house, and there are a few on the market right now, what would you tell them?
Yes. You know, be prepared. You have to really love it. You know, make sure you have a pretty deep pocketbook. The people who bought the house in 2009, the current owners, when they first bought the house, they did a pressure test of the house, and it came out as a zero. So basically, you could put your hand in front of one of these arc glass windows, and you could feel the breeze coming in. But they made sure that everything was tightened up and done properly. So you can do it that way. Spare no expense. The other approach is just absolutely love it and put on another sweater and, you know, get some extra buckets.
That's Kim Bixler, who is author of the book Growing Up in a Frank Lloyd Wright House, based on her own experience there in Rochester, New York. Kim, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Nordstrom's stock jumped nearly 20% yesterday on news that the high-end retailer may go private. The Nordstrom family is now considering acquiring all of the company, and it comes amid a lot of turmoil in the retail sector. According to the think tank Fung Global Retail and Technology, more than 3,000 store closures have been announced this year. That's more than double the same period last year. Kurt Nikisch is senior editor at Harvard Business Review. He joins us now. Hi, Kurt.
Hey, Jeremy.
And let's start with Nordstrom. What's the goal here with going private?
Well, they really think that by being private and not being sort of beholden to quarterly earnings reports, that they can actually do what they need to do to take this century-old brand, revamp it for the next 50 or 100 years. Nordstrom's, unlike a lot of other retailers, has invested a lot in like digital services, customer service, the place where a lot of other retailers cut back. So it's not in bad shape, but the family buying it back again would sort of let them continue without trying to, you know, keep their earnings up every quarter.
But does it always work out well when companies go private?
Yes and no. It happens a lot in retail. And so there are a lot of private equity companies that have taken over retailers. They've made money. Michael Dell, Dell Computer, big example, right? That company went IPO. Then he actually raised a bunch of money, bought it back again, took it private. And so there is a lot of faith that sometimes families and founders who really have like a legacy to uphold can turn a company around.
Well, J. Crew is one of the retailers that tried this. It was bought out by private equity firms in 2011. But that company is still facing troubles. And we learned this week that the CEO, Mickey Drexler, will step down. What's going on at J. Crew?
Yeah. So 10 straight quarters of declining sales. The company has $2 billion of debt. There's some rumors of bankruptcy being declared. So that's the kind of trouble that the company is in. And the funny thing is, this was a private company that went public, then tried to actually go then
private.
Was bought out, but yeah, then was private again. So it worked out once great. They tried to do it a second time, didn't find takers, and now find themselves in kind of a tricky situation.
We also learned this week that Hudson's Bay, which is the parent company of Saks Fifth Avenue and Lord & Taylor, will cut about 2,000 jobs in North America. Is this just part of the broader kind of trouble in retail, facing competition from online, et cetera?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that's 4% of the U.S. and Canadian workforce. Sales are down. Revenue is down. This is like the digital world, right? Amazon is getting bigger, taking more and more of these sales, and retailers are trying to figure out how to stay in the game long term.
The Labor Department recently released some stats comparing the job losses in retail to manufacturing and coal mines. What did they find?
Yeah, so retail jobs have gone down further in the last 15 years. Of course, you're starting from a much bigger number. So, but that does put it in perspective. It's something you don't think about. But there is a report from Credit Suisse that forecasts a bunch of malls across the U.S. closing over the next 10 or 15 years. So retail is changing slowly but surely.
And if you drive down a highway now, just about anywhere in America, you can already see a lot of these big box stores just totally empty because of what's happened there. And as you say, now malls might be going the same way. Kurt Nikisch, senior editor at Harvard Business Review, thank you.
Sure thing.
What did James Comey's testimony yesterday tell us about his relationship with the press? Unlike the president, Comey doesn't turn to Twitter to get his message past the media. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik watched yesterday's hearings, and he came away with some strong thoughts about how Comey interacts with the press. Hi, David.
Hey, Robin.
So Comey testified yesterday that after he was fired by the president started tweeting about their conversations. Take it from there. Remind us, how did Comey get his message out?
Right. And Trump had been disparaging him and the FBI under Comey's leadership. But he didn't go and make some big public statement at the National Press Club. He didn't take to Facebook with some long post or put a, you know, slap a video up on YouTube. He wanted to get it to the press and to the public without his fingerprints on it. And he talked about that yesterday. We've got a generous cut of his testimony right here. Mm-hmm.
President tweeted on Friday after I got fired that I better hope there's not tapes. I woke up in the middle of the night on Monday night because it didn't dawn on me originally that there might be corroboration for our conversation. There might be a tape. And my judgment was I needed to get that out into the public square. And so I asked a friend of mine to share the content of the memo with a reporter. Didn't do it myself for a variety of reasons, but I asked him to because I thought that might prompt the appointment of a special counsel. And so I asked a close friend of mine to do it.
So here's James Comey, one of the most senior law enforcement officials in the country, and he's explaining that he's looking at the press as a useful tool through which to convey a message publicly. He didn't, you know, he wanted a kind of transparency and accountability clearly on the president, and he may well, as some Republican critics have said, wanted to settle scores, but he wanted to use the press to get a desired result, as he said, to get a special counsel appointed, and that's exactly what happened.
Well, but is that leaking? You know, if you're out of the government, if it's your right, and by the way, he didn't give them up. He had the friend show them. Everybody knew at the time these were his notes from a friend. Is that a leak?
Well, leak is kind of a term of art rather than a specific term in statute. There's things like the Espionage Act, in which in recent years has been used to prosecute people who have leaked information to reporters, which is not really how it's been done in the past. And there are other uses. But the question is the material classified, which almost always has to do with national security and or intelligence matters? And was it wrongly released? And what did the person not have to do it? The fact that he's not in government isn't really the issue. The fact is these were not classified or privileged documents in the way that usually leaks are described. So for a former government official to share that information that he had written that contained no classified information does not seem to constitute any kind of problematic leak. Inconvenient for the White House, but not problematic.
Well, there's another moment when Comey said that Attorney General Loretta Lynch asked him not to call his inquiry into Hillary Clinton's email servers an investigation, but rather a matter. Now, today, Lynch's backers are saying that was because to call it an investigation would acknowledge there was one. Her critics say, of course, she was trying to do what President Trump did, to downplay an investigation. But how did you see Comey handle that?
Well, so in that instance, he said he was troubled, right, and that he wanted she wanted him to use rhetoric that echoed that of the Clinton campaign to call it a matter, not to use the more incendiary and correct term investigation. And Comey ultimately said that wasn't a hill he wanted to die on. He said as long as he presented his testimony straightforwardly enough and clearly enough, the press would get it. And they did get it. All of us called it an investigation. All of us grabbed the significance of what he was saying in public. And he said, you know, the press gets the game of Washington well enough, and also, to be clear, Jim Comey gets the game of Washington enough that the full thrust and import of his testimony came through, even if he sidestepped and used a word he probably shouldn't have in avoiding investigation.
So he knows how to manipulate the press, but also quite critical of the press. He pointed to one story in the New York Times, which he said got a lot wrong. This was the story in February that said Trump campaign aides had repeated contacts with Russian intelligence. What do you take from that criticism?
Well, just listening to it, it suggested a degree of contempt for the Times' coverage in that case, and more generally for the press corps. He says it's not his obligation to pick up the phone every time they get something wrong. In this instance, he says they really did. The Times, to be fair, went back, said it re-reported. It cited four sources, senior sources, in its original report, and that they say they found nothing wrong and he hasn't disclosed the problems that he had with it.
Yeah. Well, what's your takeaway from watching the testimony through the prism of press relations?
I would say Jim Comey is he may be everything that his advocates and his allies suggest, a very stalwart figure in the Justice Department, at the FBI, a very good public servant, also an incredibly skilled politician, not in the elected sense, but in terms of navigating the folk ways of Washington, how to operate things, and particularly how to use the press to his advantage and to get out the message and to frame the issues the way he wants to in times of real import. I think that's what we saw revealed by his testimony yesterday.
You told us a masterclass.
A masterclass.
NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik, thanks you.
You bet.
Okay. Well, according to Twitter, the most tweeted topic from yesterday's testimony was the questioning from Arizona Republican John McCain. Now, McCain brought up the FBI investigation of Hillary Clinton's emails announced during the elections and compared that to the FBI's then secret investigation into Russian interference in the presidential election.
That investigation was going on. This investigation is going on. You reach separate conclusions.
No, that one was done.
Investigation of any involvement of Secretary Clinton or any of her associates is completed.
Yes, as of July the 5th, the FBI completed its investigative work, and that's what I was announcing, what we had done and what we had found.
Okay, Twitter went wild. Danielle Belton, managing editor at The Root, joins us from New York. Danielle, it went on a bit. We haven't really gotten to the essence of it. But, we will say what Senator McCain has said. He hadn't had any sleep. What was the reaction online?
Oh, the reaction online went from people just laughing with hilarity over it to people just being completely concerned about his health, to being confused. Website Jezebel.com posted an article that was simply titled, quote, "Is John McCain okay? ?
Yeah. Well, others, I, for one, really enjoyed John McCain's Benadryl commercial. But the senator then, it's interesting because it's a loop here. He said, I guess Twitter, the Twitter sphere didn't get me. He acknowledged that and said he was trying to get at why Comey felt free to say no reasonable prosecutor would prosecute Clinton, which is what Comey said, stepping outside his investigator role. And he closed that investigation. But now McCain wants to know why you aren't free to say whether you think President Trump is obstructing justice. So that's what he was trying to get at, but there you go.
Got a little lost in translation.
There was a moment that's gone viral among President Trump supporters. This was from Florida Republican Senator Marco Rubio. Let's listen.
You know, this investigation is full of leaks left and right. I mean, we've learned more from the newspapers sometimes than we do from our open hearings, for sure. You ever wonder why, of all the things in this investigation, the only thing that's never been leaked is the fact that the president was not personally under investigation, despite the fact that both Democrats and Republicans and the leadership of Congress knew that and have known that for weeks?
I don't know. I find matters that are briefed to the Gang of Eight are pretty tightly held, in my experience.
Danielle, of course, as we've been hearing, President Trump could be under investigation now, even if he wasn't then. But what were the president's supporters talking about online? Because they were.
Well, the supporters, much like the president, felt Comey's testimony vindicated the president. What they saw was Comey criticizing the media, which they seized upon, along with Comey's statements that the president was not under investigation. Trump supporters proclaimed Comey, along with past Attorney General Loretta Lynch, Democrats, and the press, as all being losers, and that the GOP and Trump won the day.
Yeah. How about on the left?
On the left, this was must-see TV, where people were really fixated on how Comey pretty much just called the president a liar. They lied about the nature of his firing, that he didn't trust the president to not lie about their own encounters, hence why Comey documented their conversations. And many were fixated on Comey's statement where he said, "Lordy, I hope there are tapes," in reference to Trump alluding that he, too, might have documentation of his private conversations with the former FBI director.
You don't hear people say "Lordy" enough, I think.
No.
One more thing before you go. HBO's Bill Maher used the N-word, you know, racial slur this week. He was talking to the Republican Senator Ben Sasse, who'd invited Maher to come work in the fields with us. Maher joked he was a House N-word. You know, this is the delineation from slavery times between field and house slaves. What happened on social media?
You know, there wasn't a lot of holding back here. I mean, Leonard Pitts tweeted that Maher was a poster boy for privileged white male liberal entitlement. Activist DeRay McKesson wrote Bill Maher is going to have a string of black guests on for the next 10,000 weeks to prove he's not racist. It's so predictable and tired. Most were just flabbergasted at how unnecessary what Maher did was. But many weren't surprised. He has a history of this.
Well, funny you mentioned, rapper and actor Ice Cube's been booked, and he's going to be apparently addressing that issue. That's going to be pretty must-see TV. Danielle Belton, a managing editor at The Root, taking a look at news through social media. Thank you.
Thank you.
When you stay in a hotel, you probably leave behind barely used bars of soap. You use it once or even a few times, and then you go back home. Well, the organization Clean the World thinks that's a big waste of soap. So they recycle it and send it to people living in poverty around the world who need it to wash their hands and prevent potentially fatal illnesses. Joining us now from Orlando is Sean Seipler, who's the founder and CEO of Clean the World. Sean, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me, Jeremy.
And how did you come up with this idea to recycle hotel soap?
Well, about 8 years ago, I was a frequent traveler in hotel rooms about four nights a week. And one day I called the front desk and I asked what happened to the soap and the bottled amenities when I was done using them, because as a traveler, I never took the little bar of soap and little bottle of shampoo with me. So the front desk told me that they threw it away. And I thought that was a really interesting answer. I did some research and figured out that at that time we were throwing away about 1 million bars of soap every single day out of hotels across the United States. And, of course, I thought that was a tremendous amount of waste. So conducted further research over the next weeks and figured out a really easy way to recycle soap. But the real kind of aha moment for Clean the World came when found a bunch of studies that showed that back then, 2009, there were 9,000 children dying every day to pneumonia and diarrheal disease, a number one and number two leading cause of death amongst children worldwide. And all these studies I found show that if we just gave those children soap and if we taught them how and when to wash their hands, that we could cut those deaths in half. So for me, it was this awesome math opportunity, 1 million bars of soap being thrown away every day, 9,000 children passing every day, and all I've got to do is figure out how to get the 1 million bars recycled and into their hands, and that's really how we started Clean the World.
So how do you do it? How do you get all of those hotels to, you know, give you their soap so that you can recycle it and get it out to people who need it?
Well, we have a hotel recycling program that we offer hotels across the globe. We have about 5,000 now that are running our program, and we provide all of the elements they need so that when the housekeepers are cleaning the rooms, instead of throwing away the soap and the bottles, they put them into collection bags, take them down to Clean the World bins. Once those bins filled up, they contact Clean the World. We give them prepaid shipping labels so they can ship those bins in. We actually use UPS's carbon neutral shipping program. And once those bins come into our center, we then take it through the recycling process. So our volunteers will help sort the product. We'll put all the bottles into their right segment, shampoo, conditioner, lotion, body wash. And then the soap will go down a process where we grind it. We run it through a machine that surface cleans it. Then we mix it with a sterilization solution and remanufacture it into a brand new 3 ounce bar of soap.
And where does it go?
We have sent 40 million bars of soap across the United States and to 115 countries globally. So we're working with here in the United States primarily those that are on the SNAP program, food stamps, 42 million Americans. SNAP program, food stamps does not allow access to hygiene products. So when flu season comes along and everybody's told, you know, wash your hands, our underprivileged and underserved do not have the capability sometimes to purchase those basic hygiene products. So we're getting hygiene kits into domestic homeless shelters, relief organizations, women's shelters. Globally, we're going into areas that have high death rates due to diarrheal disease. So that's across Southeast Asia. Asia, that's Africa, that's many parts of Latin America. Haiti is one of the big areas. We have a soap in schools program, so we get children when they're young, when they're in school, we teach them how to wash their hands. If they demonstrate they can wash their hands, they get to take soap home to the family. We're seeing amazing results in areas where literally we are saving lives because of soap access and soap education.
Where do you get the money to do all of this? Because it's obviously not free to recycle the soap and send it out around the world.
We're a global social enterprise, so our 501c3 Clean the Real Foundation takes in donations. We are also a B Corp, a B Lab certified B Corp. So when the hotels engage with our program, they actually buy our recycling program. So the response from the global hospitality industry to not only implement this program, but also to fund it, to see it as a corporate social responsibility program, a sustainability program, has helped us divert 14 million pounds of waste while sending 40 million bars of soap out to those in need.
Are there still big hotel chains that haven't signed on to this yet that are still throwing away their soap?
Well, there's 5,000 hotels that run our program, and there's over about 40,000 hotels across the globe. So we've got a lot of room. Now, we do have corporate partnerships with hotel chains, Hilton, Marriott, Hyatt, Wyndham, Best Western. Those folks are on board with our program. Disney, Caesar, Sands. We are still approaching the individual hotels, the individual franchise owners to get them on board. So, you know, it's important for guests as they're going into hotels, when they book a hotel, are you recycling your soap and your bottled amenities? So it's very important that we have the consumer, the public, knowing about the program and being the ones at the forefront of really talking about it to the hotel so that they will get on board and adopt the program.
That's Sean Seipler, who is founder and CEO of Clean the World, which recycles hotel soap. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And we'll link you to more information about Clean the World at hereandnow.org. Meanwhile, this afternoon on All Things Considered, Canada is trying to build its technology sector, and we'll hear how it's taking advantage of uncertainty in the U.S. about immigration rules and work visas to accomplish that goal. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.